From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Bush administration has inaugurated its TV ad campaign with four new commercials, and here's what one prominent ad critic had to say, and I quote, "The first official Bush-Cheney ads are on the air, and holy smokes, we want to vote for him, we want to work for him, we want to have his baby." That critic is Bob Garfield, who, in addition to being the co-host of this program, is the longtime and much-feared ad critic for Ad Age, and he's followed election ads since how long, Bob?
I guess since the midterm elections in 86.
So we thought we'd save time and money and tap him for his expertise rather than for his golden voice and good cheer, as we usually do. So, Bob, what's so great about these ads?
Well, first of all, as a matter of full disclosure, I am no George Bush fan. But as political advertising, which I would say historically has been pretty much a stain on our democracy, this is really outstanding and generally inspires you with optimism. And you see a man who would appear to be a confident, able leader in full charge with a vision for the future.
I know exactly where I want to lead this country. I know what we need to do to make the world more free and more peaceful. I know what we need to do to make sure every person has a chance at realizing the American dream. I know what we need to do to continue economic growth so people can find work.
These are beautifully shot, beautifully edited, and I think it's admirable for what they don't say as for what they do.
And what they don't use are a lot of images of the burning towers, just a few seconds, but that's been enough to spark outrage from some firefighters and families of the victims.
First of all, it's not a few seconds. It's actually less than 1 second in two separate commercials. And secondly, the fact is that it is certainly central to the campaign, certainly to this president's themes in the campaign. And he can scarcely be deprived talking about 9/11. If he didn't, it would be the elephant in the room, wouldn't it?
But it would probably behoove him to make only slight and occasional reference to that elephant, lest he get slammed with more charges of exploitation.
And clearly, the president's campaign team have anticipated the potential problems by being as circumspect as they have been. Based on the document itself, which I have scrutinized quite substantially, I see no basis for the charge of exploitation.
So we've just come off a campaign where the would-be Democratic nominees went relatively easy on each other and relatively hard on the president. Now we're down to one nominee, obviously, and the Bush ads were produced before the president knew with certainty who his opponent would be.
Yeah, and so therefore you can enjoy them for about 5 minutes, because if history is any judge, this feel-good, optimistic tone will quickly disappear, and it'll pretty much be all Kerry bashing all the time. And at least in the year 2000, the optimism, I'm a uniter, I'm not a divider, compassionate, conservative stuff, quickly went out the window for tactical commercials that quite savaged Al Gore. In those days, much of this could be done by proxies. That's not so easy under the new rules. So the Bush-Cheney campaign will have to do it themselves.
Let me ask you about those new rules. In this election cycle, we do have the new stand-by-your ad requirement mandated by the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform law, which calls for the candidate to say they endorsed whatever ad is playing. So do you think that will reduce the mudslinging of yesteryear?
All I can say is I expect an equal amount of mudslinging. I just expect that some of the phrasing will be a little more delicate, and maybe some of the cheap tricks to generate voter anger and so forth, like minor chords played underneath very grim black and white shots of the political opponent, you know, made to appear more like a child molester than the Democratic nominee. You know, that might take a brief holiday, but there's just no question in my mind but that the Bush-Cheney campaign is going to hit hard against nominee Kerry, and the president will stand by the ads.
Now, we did see a pretty tough anti-Kerry ad produced by the Bush-Cheney campaign on the internet. And, of course, McCain-Feingold doesn't apply to ads on the internet. So do you think that's where the fur will really fly?
Well, let's see. What do I say? Brooke, well, that's the $64,000 question. Actually, no. I think it suited the Bush-Cheney campaign originally to do it that way, to get around the stand-by-your-ad provisions. But you can't do that for the whole campaign, because undecided voters are not going to go rushing to the website. So if they want to reach undecided voters, particularly those in swing states, they're going to have to advertise, then they're going to have to do it on television.
I think they're both going to get a lot more bang for their buck because of people like us who will spend all their time in the absence of other news simply dissecting their ads.
Yeah, it's called free media. You know, even if the president or Senator Kerry says something nasty in an ad and it's portrayed unflatteringly in the media, the fact is the message is still out there and it hasn't cost them a nickel.
Bob, thanks so much for everything.
Well, Brooke, it's nice to be on the show. I hope to do it again.
The deliberate and deadly attacks were more than acts of terror. They were acts of war. This will require our country to unite, steadfast determination and resolve.
One of the president's new campaign commercials? Wrong. This is the trailer for a new action series now being pitched by Steeple Productions called DHS The Series. Characters include legendary special agent Jack Callahan, played by Tim Cavanaugh, and intelligence analyst Andrea Bacall, played by Allison Herruth Waterbury, who range near and far in pursuit of evildoers who hate our freedom. DHS stands for the Department of Homeland Security, which celebrated its first birthday Monday, and so far, its record is mixed. Watchdogs say DHS is woefully underfunded, its intelligence unit understaffed, its monitoring capabilities hobbled. But its action figure version on the small screen is breathtaking.
We gotta get these people out of here!
Hey, Johnny, do me a favor. Say a prayer!
Steeple representatives told E! Online that, quote, no other television series has ever had such access and clearance at the highest levels of real-life counterterrorism agencies, including the White House, the FBI, the EPA, and, of course, the DHS itself. Joseph Medawar is the show's executive producer. Allison Herruth Waterbury is another producer and the show's co-star. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
The characters are fictional, and the storylines are also fictional. These things have not really happened, or at least not yet.
Right. These things that could happen, and some international scenarios have happened.
Do you use any actual footage or any real-life characters?
We are trying to use as many actual footage as possible.
The government has opened up multiple sites for us to actually film on as they're going through their training sessions. And what they do is they put me or Tim Cavanaugh in the midst of everything that's going on, and they allow us to film. And the government support has just been phenomenal at that level. And our passion is to educate. We're trying to bring as much truth to the screen by doing thorough research and using Gray Davis and Ron Angeese and Ariel Sharon, spokesperson. These are people who want to come and play themselves because they also have an interest in portraying what Homeland Security does and how the different governments from different countries interact with one another.
Now, you'll remember that the creation of the Homeland Security Department was not without its share of debate, and 1 year later, there continues to be real questions raised about its overall effectiveness. Are you at all concerned that the unvarnished heroes of the plot lines in your shows will eclipse the very legitimate real-life concerns about the DHS?
You know what? DHS is, you know, from our point of view, is very strong for us in the U.S. We need it. Is it perfected to where we want it to be? I think there's always room for improvement in every area. But it's not a show about promoting the government. It's about educating.
But don't you think the education value is somewhat impaired if you don't show any of the warts?
Yes, of course those need to be displayed and shown so you can learn from them. I cannot judge, and I wouldn't even want to say publicly where I feel their weak areas are, because there's very few people that are there, I believe, for the wrong reasons. Now, whether they are right or wrong, again, is a perception, but they have to believe in what they're doing.
You know, it's not inconsistent to recognize the heroism of participants in an agency and yet raise questions about the efficiency of an agency. The trailer that you posted on your website, if it's any indication of the overall flavor of your series, we see an almost invariably effective endeavor. And the power of fiction might lead viewers to think that that is the way the Homeland Security Department operates, when in fact there are some very real problems that if the public were aware of, they might help to address.
We have every intention of bringing those things to the air. You've merely seen a 2 to 3 minute trailer. And you don't have our storyline, and, you know, that is changing every day.
To what extent is the White House and the Department of Homeland Security involved in the program?
We try to give, on a every two-week basis, a complete package of what we're filming and what the story's about to the proper authorities that we are working with here in California at the governor's office, and they pass it on. And it continues to the right channels, and the person with us is Congressman Rohrabacher from our district.
Rohrabacher is the one who has had contact with a complete conversation with the president. We know that he knows about it. We told him ourselves personally.
The president?
Yeah, we met with him for a photo op, and we briefly ran it by him with the little time that we had.
Before we saw the president, we had a very nice conversation with Karl Rove on where we are and how far we're going with it. When Mr. Tom Ridge came to Los Angeles to inspire the entertainment division of doing shows about the department, the head of our production had met with him. There was tremendous amount of enthusiasm and excitement. And I, if I may add something, it was very funny. Our head of production turned to Mr. Ridge and said, who would you like to see play your part? And Mr. Ridge kind of giggled and he said, hold off 2 years, maybe I'll come back and play it myself.
So Tom Ridge himself went to Los Angeles to try and get the entertainment industry interested in producing programs that would bring the message of Homeland Security and the war on terror to the people.
Well, absolutely. They're assembling an office in Los Angeles for producers, writers, directors to be able to contact for authenticity and information to help filmmakers deliver a right message.
But are we all absolutely in agreement on what the right message is?
Absolutely not. And we would be fools to say that we did. We do know that we need to fight terrorism on an international level, and it shouldn't be tolerated at any level. That's the only one thing that I feel that the majority of the people in this world do agree on.
All right. Allison Herruth Waterbury is star and co-producer of DHS The Series. Allison, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
And Joseph Medawar is the show's executive producer. Thank you, too.
Thank you. Secret agent man, secret
agent man, how they've given you a number. Coming up, when to use the word genocide, sourcing at the New York Times, and Howard Stern, clown or martyr?
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the northern African nation of Sudan is gathering yet another contemporary humanitarian disaster. Just as a reported peace agreement brokered by the Bush administration seemed to promise an end to a 20-year north-south civil war, armed conflict erupted in the remote western region of Darfur. As many as a million citizens have fled their homes, and more than 100,000 refugees have spilled across the border into neighboring Chad. Survivors tell stories of looting and burning of villages, racially motivated killings, and rapes. U.S. coverage of Darfur has been limited, but in recent weeks, some scattered alarms are sounding. A February 25th op-ed in the Washington Post called the conflict in Darfur the unnoticed genocide. But in a National Public Radio interview last Saturday, Refugees International's Ken Bacon sidestepped labeling the conflict.
I hate to dodge this, but I think it's probably too early to tell whether there's actual genocide taking place. Access is very limited. There's been very little press coverage. The government won't let people in. Plus, it's very insecure. There have been allegations, but we won't know until we can get human rights investigators in there.
Joining me now is Samantha Power, a former Balkan war correspondent, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide. Samantha, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Explain for us, please, who the principal victims seem to be and who seems to be responsible.
I think most of us who have thought about Sudan over the course of the last two decades have thought about the conflict and indeed even the potential genocide there as being one in which the Muslim government, the National Islamic Front government, has taken aim at Christians in the south. And that is where a major peace process has actually taken hold between those two entities. But what you have in Darfur, which has confused people because it doesn't fit the mold of what we understand the ethnic conflict in Sudan to be about, is actually Muslim-on-Muslim violence. It is ethnically motivated violence, it seems. It's Arab Muslims who have been armed and trained by the Sudanese government in Khartoum, taking aim at African Muslims who occupy land that I think the Khartoum government would very much like to see in Arab hands. Right now you have about 700,000 African Muslims within Sudan who have been displaced and who are living in horrific conditions by all accounts. You have another 100,000 that have made it over the border into Chad. They describe taunts by the militia members in which the threat of extermination is issued. They describe promises on the part, again, of these Arab Muslims that all of the Africans will be, you know, taken out of Sudan by the time the campaign is over. So there are very worrying signs about a larger, fairly systematic campaign aimed at the destruction of this African Muslim group.
Which would suggest that what is afoot now is ethnic cleansing. Nobody seems to have said it aloud, but if it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and yet still hemming and hawing, why is it happening this way?
Well, I don't know how much hemming and hawing there is really around the phrase ethnic cleansing. I think where we start to get the dance, the what I call the G-word shuffle, is around the language of genocide. The nervousness comes from a few places. First of all, it's actually just genuinely hard to get in and to confirm with one's own eyes. So one gets nervous about invoking language and inflammatory language, but that is its own red flag. One of the things that people who are intent on committing genocide do, first and foremost, is they keep outsiders out. The second reason there's a nervousness about using it, especially on the part of aid agencies and I think on the part of journalists and editorial writers, is this fear of crying wolf. There is, you know, a stigma associated with the word genocide that one could imagine retaining only if you use it very selectively. The third reason that people are hesitant is that there's, of course, major confusion about what genocide is and, you know, whether it requires outright extermination of an ethnic, national, or religious group. So I think a lot of people just shy from using the word because they want to leave it to the lawyers after the fact to determine it.
I want to ask you about the press's role in understanding how these conflicts are viewed outside of where they're taking place.
One of the problems with, I think, the way we in the press tend to cover conflict is we have traditionally allowed our priorities to be set by policymakers who, of course, are not going to go out of their way to draw attention to conflicts that they may not want to do anything about. In this instance, this Khartoum government's killing and ethnic cleansing of these African Sudanese Muslims is very, very inconvenient. It comes at a time when Washington, it seems, is on the verge of having secured a peace agreement between Khartoum and the Christian South that would have been a real feather in the cap of this administration. This is not a place that the Bush administration wants to draw attention to right now, and thus the initiative for bringing this up really has to come in Washington from the people in the press corps to put the administration in a position where it has to respond, where it has to send fact finders out. And so I think that's one function that the press performs, is an agenda-setting function in Washington. But the second function, of course, is to get there and to bring not merely secondhand reports, but firsthand encounters with people who have experienced these atrocities. The worst thing we in the press can do at a time like this is to accept government assurances, you know, that the violence has ceased and that access can't be granted for our own safety and security, you know, because of lingering rebel forces. And that's usually, again, a clear signal that there are tidying operations being conducted out of our line of vision. But I think as we look back on our record in the 1990s, we as a profession can be relatively pleased with our staying power when it came to the conflict and the crisis in the former Yugoslavia, and quite embarrassed, actually, about how we covered the Rwanda genocide.
In your book, you observe that, I'm going to quote you here, during the conflict in Bosnia, U.S. officials had tried to convince journalists that the conflict was the product of ancient tribal hatreds. And in Rwanda, you say that reporters in the field, quote, adopted this frame on their own. And now Amnesty International's report on Sudan suggests that the Sudanese government is characterizing the violence as tribal, telling the outside world, I guess, don't bother yourself with this. These are just Sudanese doing what Sudanese do. Will the media once again be suckers for that argument?
Well, one hopes not. it became such a standard alibi. You know, the title of my book is A Problem from Hell, and that was Warren Christopher's characterization of the violence in Bosnia. It was a problem from hell. You know, we'll never make these people like one another. They've been killing one another for centuries. Well, there may well have been incidents of ethnic killing and conflict over the centuries, but it has been a kind of time-tested and quite successful alibi used both by perpetrators and by bystanders.
All right. Well, Samantha, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Samantha Power is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide.
The New York Times has issued new rules on when and how to use anonymous sources. This follows similar actions from the Boston Globe and Washington Post, among others. The rules stipulate that an anonymous source should be used only in situations where the story could not otherwise be reported, and that the reporter should reveal what might motivate that source to speak. New York Times Assistant Managing Editor and Standards Editor Al Siegel helped write those rules, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what's new here?
The main new thing is that we now require, and we say out loud that we require, some editor in this organization to know the identity of every anonymous source we quote in the paper. We used to be able, on a very sensitive story, to send a reporter out, and the reporter could say to the source, "You're only talking to me. No one else will ever know who you are." That's not true anymore.
So generally speaking, what do you think are the main problems with over-reliance on unidentified sources?
People take advantage of news organizations, ours included, to float information without taking responsibility for it. And some of them think that then leaves them free to change their story later on, since no one can hold them to what they said. And when you fill a story with sources said, or authoritative sources, or government sources, a careful reader is not going to be as convinced of the truthfulness and reliability of that information as if you were able to say very specifically, if not whom you're quoting, then what kind of person, what kind of position were they in? How did they know all this?
I'd like to go over an example with you. On Monday, the same day that the new policy went into effect, the Times ran a front-page story about the fall of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. It was written by Christopher Marquis, a Washington correspondent, and was pretty much based exclusively on information provided by, quote, a senior State Department official. So basically, it described Aristide's final hours in Haiti and his decision to resign and his middle-of-the-night trip to the airport with only his small inner circle. Now, since that article was written, we've heard from several people, including the South African ambassador to the UN and, of course, Aristide himself, disputing aspects of the Times story. In retrospect, do you think that this article's use of sources was consistent with the Times policy?
It was consistent with our policy because it was necessary. At that time, there was only one account available to us. That account came from the government, and people in the business of diplomacy and international affairs and national security simply do not, as a matter of policy, speak for attribution. If you want to know what the State Department thinks or what the State Department says, you have to be prepared to withhold the names of the people you speak to.
So would you say then that there are, in effect, two sourcing policies, one that simply has to apply to certain agencies of the federal government and one that applies to everyone else?
I wouldn't say that there are two. I would say that there's a kind of sliding scale. The more important the information is, the more tolerant we have to be about the inability to put names on it. And then there are things all the way down the line to public relations people for companies who are just trying to cover their backs sometimes when they won't let you use their names. And there we quite simply should refuse to take information.
According to the New York Times policy, and I'm quoting here, when we use such sources, anonymous sources, we accept an obligation not only to convince the reader of their reliability, but also to convey what we can learn of their motivation. Do you think this was done in the Marquis story?
I don't think there was any particular motivation. I think that they were describing to us what they thought they knew the facts were on the ground at that time. If we find out that this story was wrong, we are likely to be very upfront about it and to apply some heat, both personally and in print, to the people who fed us this version on Sunday for Monday's paper. But I don't think it's necessary to assume that they're wrong because the government has on occasion been wrong.
So you don't think that the story on Aristide's departure required that level of skepticism?
There was no reason at that time to be skeptical about it. I don't think there were sources available to give us any other version.
Right. But I wonder, is it up to reporters to convince readers of the reliability of government officials and to make explicit any and all interest the government might have in a given story? Or should a reader bring that skepticism to anything they read in a newspaper?
I think we owe the reader the background. This particular story is full of background. And I'm noticing that the headline says Aristide flees after a shove from the U.S. So we didn't make it look as if he packed his bag at leisure and decided, I think I'll spend a few days in the Central African Republic.
The reason why I'm hammering away at this is obviously this is a time when the government is coming under increasing scrutiny for its credibility. We have all the reasons for the run-up to war that have been subsequently examined. And some newspapers applied what I guess they considered to be the appropriate degree of trust when receiving information that may have been a little bit cooked. And I wonder whether a heightened skepticism isn't appropriate in circumstances like this.
Skepticism is always appropriate. Cynicism, in the absence of any basis for it, is not appropriate. I don't think that government spinning is a new phenomenon. And the reason for a policy of identifying your sources as fully as you can and describing them as completely as you can is to make clear to the reader that you don't know what the facts are. You just know what you've been told.
All right. Al Siegel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Al Siegel is assistant managing editor and standards editor at The New York Times.
This week, The Wall Street Journal reported that the FCC is poised to slam radio shock jock Howard Stern with a hefty fine for indecency. This follows Clear Channel's dropping Stern from its lineup last week. When that happened, I observed in a commentary that Clear Channel's action was an eloquent argument against media consolidation, because what if this were not the squelching of a class clown, but of a political voice? But several listeners wrote to charge that it was, in fact, political speech that did Stern in with Clear Channel. They said that his show had not become raunchier in recent weeks. The big change was that 3 days before Clear Channel dropped him, Stern came out hard against President Bush. It's an interesting question, one that we'll now pose to Eric Bollert, who frequently writes about radio, especially Clear Channel, for Salon.com. Eric, welcome back. Listen, I want to play you some tape.
What's the name of Mel Gibson's movie?
The Passion of the Christ.
The Passion of the Stern. Special appearance by Yucko the Clown. Something like that. Michael Powell is Pontius Pilate.
Is Howard Stern a Christ figure, Eric?
In his mind, I'm sure he is.
Now, as to the assertions of our letter writers, there was this remarkable coincidence of Stern's turn against President Bush with the decision by Clear Channel to kick him off the air. Does that make any sense to you?
I can understand where the theory comes from because, as we said, he'd been a relatively strong backer of President Bush, very pro-war a year ago. He had just come back from a week's vacation and announced he had read Al Franken's book and announced it was a masterpiece and that he was not going to vote for Bush. So it was 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes about how awful Bush was. And this week we've heard about how Bush stole the election and the economy's in the toilet. You know, it's been pretty rampant. So he comes out against Bush and all of a sudden 3 days later he's off the air. So, yeah, I mean, I understand why people come up with that theory. When you understand Clear Channel's background, it's known as being very conservative, based in Texas, very close to Bush Sr. and Bush 43, very close to the White House, gave a lot of money to Republicans. So that's where the two theories come together. But I think the overriding concern for Clear Channel was the indecency, was the congressional hearing last week. They had just fired notorious shock jock Bubba the Love Sponge last week in preparations for the hearings. And then they sort of went the extra step and kicked Howard Stern off all six of the stations that were carrying it. So I think their main concern was Congress. Their main concern was legislative oversight. Their main concern was the FCC wanting to increase by tenfold the amount of future indecency fines. So they basically threw Howard under the bus and went up to Congress.
To play devil's advocate here, Clear Channel had six stations on which the Stern show appeared, but still Stern appears on three dozen stations around the country, major markets all. So it's not as though he has been squelched.
You can argue both sides of it. You know, people who think this is a political speech would say, well, gee, where was he dumped? He was dumped in Florida and Pennsylvania and Kentucky. You know, those are swing states for the election. And the flip side would say, as you did, you know, six markets, you know, it's not like he's not on the air. Millions of people are still hearing his criticisms of Bush. Odds are when they figure out the contracts at those six stations, he'll pop up somewhere else in those markets. So, you know, it's an interesting theory. I think Clear Channel does like Republicans. I think they like ratings and revenues more. And I think they fear the FCC more than they fear Howard Stern. But again, he had just really come out very strong against Bush, and then, you know, poof, he sort of disappears. So, you know, I understand where the theory comes from.
Well, Eric, as always, thanks very much.
Sure thing.
Eric Bollert is a senior writer for Salon.com. He spoke to us from station WBGO in Newark, New Jersey.
Coming up, pirating movies in Mexico and making movies about movies right here at home.
This is On the Media from NPR.
The Academy Awards aired in Mexico last weekend, and you can pretty much be sure that during the week that followed, thousands of Mexicans stopped at some stand along some street to see if they might find Monster or Mystic River among the pirated DVDs on display. The Motion Picture Association of America estimates 16 million pirated films could be produced in Mexico this year. Mexico is now officially calling piracy organized crime, and under U.S. pressure is stepping up efforts to find and prosecute the worst offenders. But some DVD distributors are taking an enterprising new tack: give the people what they want. And they're selling legal DVDs to street vendors cheaper than the fakes. OTM's Marianne McCune reports from Mexico City.
The vendor who sells illegal DVDs outside the Philosophy Building in Mexico's largest public university says he didn't know much about movies when he started out. He was a delivery guy before this, he says, and he took up selling DVDs after being laid off. Now, because customers here request Citizen Kane instead of SWAT, or the return of Martin Guerre over Armageddon, he's kind of a buff.
How can I tell you? They're intellectual, so they're looking for films with this sense of humanism.
So, he says, in addition to supporting his own family, he's making culture available to people who can't afford to buy it legally.
I
come here because I'm a professor, and a lot of times I bring films to my students about topics relevant to what we are doing.
It bothers Professor Hector Alvarez a tiny bit that he's buying illegal copies.
But sometimes not so much, because I feel that these are big economic powers and they also have to take a little hit.
Industry experts say in Mexico alone, piracy costs the film industry about $70 million a year.
Nosotros consideramos que por cada copia,
Ricardo Hernandez is with the Mexican distributor Quality Films and says they estimate that for each DVD they sell, five illegal copies are sold. But that's because the pirated copies are so cheap. And to capture that part of the market, Quality has decided to lower prices through street vendors. The idea came from Francisco Guerra with the Mexico office of the Motion Picture Association of America.
Si Mexico es un país de 100 millones de habitantes.
If Mexico is a country of 100 million people, but 63 million are poor or very poor, we can't think of combating piracy if we don't also have an option for poor people.
You've got to address the economic problem, he says, as well as the criminal one. There are individuals and gangs in Mexico who actually oversee the production and distribution of millions of illegal DVDs. Those are the people you prosecute. Then there are the individual vendors who buy a slew of pirated copies each week and turn them around for a profit of a dollar or two each. Those are the people Guerra wants to lure to his side.
We have to find a vendor, but also give him a way out.
So Guerra has organized a team of five distributors from Mexico and the United States to sell about 600 of their titles to street vendors for under $4 each, less than what Mexicans pay for a high-quality illegal copy of a popular movie. Guerra works closely with federal police. When they tell him they've identified a vendor who's interested in selling legal DVDs, Guerra goes out to meet with them. Since last June, those distributors have sold 700,000 legal DVDs on the street. It's a can't-beat-'em-join-'em strategy in a country where law enforcement doesn't come close to solving the problem. This computer programming student sells DVDs in Mexico City's center. She says federal police come as often as twice a month to confiscate every illegal DVD she has. But the loss isn't great enough to stop her from reopening shop that same day with a new selection. And she believes the police turn around and sell the DVDs they take from her. She has no proof, she says. It's just how things happen in this country. The widely held perception, true or not, that no authority in Mexico is untouched by corruption makes it all the more difficult to convince vendors to give it up. But if the argument is economic, that you can make a living selling legal DVDs, then they might be convinced. In the heart of Tepito, the hectic neighborhood known for supplying cheap illegal copies to the rest of the city's vendors, this young man is working one of 20 stands now selling legal, low-cost DVDs. He explains he and his brother opted for legal over illegal copies for peace of mind. They pay tax on their purchases and can show receipts from Quality Films and VideoMax to prove it. The funny thing is, some of the customers can't seem to believe the DVDs are legit. Alfonso Mendoza points to the shelves of legal DVDs and says, assuredly, these appear to be originals, but they're not. They give them these tags, but it's false. Civil engineer Carlos Galvez believes they're real, but he lowers his voice to tell me they're most likely stolen. The other funny thing is, though vendors who agree to sell the low-price legal DVDs are supposed to give up selling illegal copies, here in the stand, directly across from the shelf of originals, is an equally ample shelf of illegal copies. Customers are thumbing through films that are still in theaters. One is watching a copy of Return of the King to verify the quality before buying it. Any street vendor here will tell you the newest titles sell best. And that will be one of the biggest obstacles to the legal distributor's success. They can't afford to offer new releases or their most popular films at $4 a pop. But Francisco Guerra says his list of titles do sell. Art house movies such as Dancer in the Dark or old-time Mexican movies have been popular. And every month he plans to add 60 new titles to the 600 already in the mix. The vendor at Tepito's half-legitimate DVD stand says he's doing just about as well now as he was before he opted to sell the legal DVDs. No better, no worse. Guerra says he just needs to get the word out. By the end of this year, he expects to have helped sell 2 million legal DVDs on Mexico's streets. And those vendors who don't buy into his proposal risk outing themselves as criminals, not true victims of the economy.
The only way to check them out is to make them an offer. Here's the offer. Take it. It's a cheap product. It's good. You're not going to have problems. You're going to make a living, a good one. And if they say no,
they just might get another visit from the federal police, this time with a less generous agenda. For On the Media, I'm Marianne McCune in Mexico City.
While pirates roll their cameras on movies they don't own, movie makers have a long tradition of training their lenses on themselves. WNYC's Sarah Fishko looks back at an Academy Award-winning look in the mirror 3 decades ago.
Ready?
Roll 33, take one.
Lights out.
It is just 30 years since the François Truffaut film Day for Night won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. Day for Night took us along on a fictional film shoot as an average, somewhat sentimental feature was created by its cast, crew, and director, played by Truffaut himself.
Give me a 5 kilowatt on the fireplace.
Day for Night is a love letter to the filmmaking process.
Now put a screen in front of the 5 kilowatt or we won't see the fire.
And also to the family that forms around a picture and then disbands.
Family crew wanted in the projection room.
Here they are. It's about time.
It adores the chemistry of actors with one another and the sorcery performed on the set and in the editing room.
Start the rain. Less rain.
There hasn't been such a positive, loving portrait of the process since, well, ever. You only have to go back a couple of decades before Truffaut and change the location to Hollywood to see the politics and pain filmmakers chose to show us in movies about their own business. In The Bad and the Beautiful, there are some early, heady days of filmmaking.
Suppose we never do show the Catmen. Is that what you're thinking?
Exactly.
No Catmen!
Kirk Douglas and Barry Sullivan throwing it together on a shoestring.
Now, what we put on the screen, it'll make the backs of their necks crawl.
But it doesn't take long before the producer is taking credit for the director's work.
I'd rather hurt you now than kill you off forever.
Cutting him out of the deal.
You're just not ready to direct $1 million picture.
Filmmaking becomes a more sinister process, with more at stake.
You're stealing my picture. It was my idea. I gave it to you.
In the movies about movies, it is the producers who are larger than life, larger than movies, even.
Without me, it would have stayed an idea.
They are. After all, the ones with all the power. And power seems to be what it is all about, even more than money, and certainly more than art. And working in the movies is all about being trapped. In Clifford Odette's play and later film of the late 50s, The Big Knife, it is very much about the power struggle between a movie star.
I'll promise you anything you want if you'll just let me go.
And a tyrannical producer.
A boy like you, who are you?
Played to the hilt by Rod Steiger.
I built the studio. I, with my brain and my hand, I ripped it out of the world. And who are you? No.
In this one, process doesn't enter into it. 90% of The Big Knife takes place in one Bel Air living room, which I guess is itself part of the trap. The poor guy can't get out of that palatial room or his contract, and that's what it's about.
You there. Why are you so late?
So is Sunset Boulevard, when you think about it.
Why have you kept me waiting so long?
In that classic, everybody pays a price for the glamorous haze that is the movie world. And everybody's trapped.
We didn't need dialogue. We had faces.
Norma Desmond trapped in a big old mansion, looking at the image of herself as she once was.
I'll show them. I'll be up there again, so help me.
Eric von Stroheim as a former director, trapped as her butler.
She was the greatest of them all. You wouldn't know. You're too young.
A struggling writer having brushed up against all this under the oddest possible circumstances.
Well, I sure turned into an interesting driveway.
Finding himself trapped.
I'll get your things together and let's get out of here.
Unable to give it up.
All my things? All my 18 suits, all my custom-made shoes, and the 6 dozen shirts, and the cufflinks, and the platinum keychains, and the cigarette cases?
Decades later, in the film Inside Daisy Clover, Daisy, Natalie Wood, pays every imaginable price.
Incredible as it may seem, I'm going to make something out of you.
Her mother is locked up in an institution to leave young Daisy free for stardom.
There's a certain mixture of orphan and clown that always packs them in.
The matinee idol she marries takes off on their wedding night, and finally her very sanity is the price she pays.
Will you give us a level, please, Daisy?
1, 2, 3, 4.
Fine.
As she plays a full-blown mad scene in the dubbing studio. The producer, of course, is unmoved.
Look here, if she's sane, cure her. If she's mad, certify her. I want her cured so I can finish my picture, or certified so I can collect insurance.
And Daisy is trapped by her own success. In State and Maine, a movie shoot takes over a small town where they are all trapped in endless pre-production.
Claire has a problem.
Wally, if I have some moment of your time, look at this. This shot, I cannot do the shot you want.
Why not?
With rewrites and tantrums and machination.
I don't want to take my shirt off, and I can't. What are these things they're asking of me? What? I try to be good.
Long before anyone says action.
Roll camera. Speed.
The fires of home. Scene one, take one.
Marker.
In The Player.
Lunching with the enemy.
They're even trapped at lunch.
Can we talk about something other than Hollywood for a change?
Yeah. Yes.
We're educated people.
Sure.
Life is in development hell.
I like Goldie. I like Goldie.
Okay, great. Goldie we have a relationship, and that would
Goldie
be great.
Goldie goes to Africa.
Writers circle around the studios.
Find out from studio security how Adam Simon got on the lot. I want to know.
Adam Simon? Okay.
A murder is committed.
Keep it to yourself!
It is, after all, the only way out of the trap of being rich, successful, and in power in the dream factory. There's even a film called The Oscar.
Here's a fellow who needs no introduction, Frankie Thane, one of the five nominees.
Which can be found in the cult films section of a certain downtown video store listed under Midnight Movies.
This is a chancy business, Frankie. You never know you're on the way out till you suddenly realize it would take a ticket to get back in.
It tells the story of a movie star who is, yes, trapped by the glamour and success he's been able to achieve as he begins a slide downward.
You've just been nominated for an Oscar.
What? I can't hear you.
I'm at the Academy, and they just released the Oscar nominations.
Only the prospect of an Academy Award gives him renewed credibility and clout, so he can once again, if you'll pardon the expression, call the shots.
Hey, Frankie, congratulations.
And what about Day for Night? What's truly amazing is that 30 years ago, the late, great François Truffaut did manage to make that entertaining, upbeat, charming film about the same dirty business that almost every other director has dumped on mercilessly before and since. Could he have made that movie now, knowing all we know now? Between the E! Channel, Project Greenlight, Peter Biskin's new book Down and Dirty Pictures, backstage documentaries and unauthorized biographies, camcorders, desktop editing, inside the actor's studio, with all that, who needs fiction? Maybe audiences know it all too well. But Truffaut knew the secret, that the beauty of it is on the set and in the cutting room, in the actual act of making the thing, in burying your head in the question of which vase will work better on which table, which angle will flatter, which cut will surprise the viewer. Whether it's great art or just ordinary entertainment, you still have to make those decisions. You still have to sweat. To him, the fun is in the sweating. For an audience, the fun is in the watching, and that includes even a good trashy movie about making movies, even if most of them are not about making movies at all.
Cut! Hold it!
For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fischko.
And finally this week, an argument among journalists over whether to give Jason Blair, the disgraced fabricator and plagiarizer formerly of the New York Times, free publicity on his book tour. Karen Brown Dunlop, president of the Poynter Institute that focuses on journalistic practices, wrote that it made her furious that instead of fading from the spotlight, Blair is poised to make some money. But NBC's Katie Couric defended the primetime exposure she gave to Blair by saying, "If we based all of our interviews on people who are doing good in the world, sadly, we'd be sorely limited." Given that we cover the media, we have to side with Couric. So here with our review of Burning Down My Master's House by Jason Blair is OTM book critic Stephen Glassman.
Awaited with a combination of curiosity and revulsion by the nation's journalism and literary elites, Burning Down My Master's House is a picaresque romp through Jason Blair's experiences as a seventh-degree mason, motorcycle stunt driver, and host of his own children's TV show in American Samoa. Blair's madcap escapades are intricately intertwined with the heroic battles for survival of Blair's infant sextuplets, Jason, Mason, Jolson, Gypsum, Ginseng, and Brittany. The storytelling is masterful, the prose inimitable. This stunning confessional is a triumph. Or, as Blair writes in his stirring final chapter, "'Tis a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done."
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe, Rob Christensen, Scott Strickland, and Irene Trudell. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.